Hello, and welcome back to Her Voice, Ladies Who Write, a podcast showcasing the works of little-known yet brilliant female authors. My name is Clementine, and today we'll be looking at Fanny Raoul, a French writer and fierce activist who fought for women's access to politics in early 19th century France. Born between 1771 and 1779 in Saint-Paul-de-Léon, a small town in Bretagne, France, Marie-Françoise Raoul, known as Fanny Raoul, is raised in a modest milieu. Her mother, to whom she owes her name, dies in childbirth, while her father, Claude René, is a bookkeeper and Saint-Paul's first magistrate. Adamant about giving his daughter a meticulous education, he sends her to a convent where she spends most of her teenagehood. It should be said that very little is known of this discreet yet fiery woman's personal endeavors. Of her impetuous journey and lifelong battle for women's rights were only left writings. But perhaps this was exactly what Raoul wanted to be remembered as, an author. In order to truly comprehend Raoul's impact, it is necessary to consider the context in which she writes. In 1789, the French Revolution, period of upheaval and political turmoil, marks the beginning of a new era, that of the end of the absolute monarchy, the old regime, and even more significant, the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Men and Citizen. Invisible in the political sphere during the old regime, women gradually become more noticeable, as the crisis is favorable for their emergence. Between 1789 and 1793, women in France obtain a certain number of rights. In particular, they are provided with a new civil existence as well as a legal identity. In other words, women are no longer minors in the eyes of the law. But despite this civil breakthrough, women are still excluded from the political sphere. Indeed, many revolutionaries expressed a wish to restrict the political body to men only. As such, women are still refused political rights, and despite female sans-culottes demands, they are still denied the right to vote, to join the National Guard, and to bear arms. Men maintain that women are not suited to be involved in the political sphere, making their new model of citizenship based on universalism rather ironic, since male citizens' political rights are not being extended to female citizens. Women nonetheless continue their battle to occupy the political space, with female figures like Manon Roland or Pauline Léon leading multiple revolutionary events in favor of women's rights. In October 1789, they namely marched to Versailles to complain about the rise of the price of bread and the difficulty finding usable flour, and demand that they be given weapons and ammunition. This fiery demonstration leads the king to be brought back to Paris, showing the power of women's voices in holding the state accountable for their actions. Furthermore, this period sees the emergence of a multitude of feminist political movements, with women gradually becoming more and more vocal about their grievances. From the evolution of women's voices in the political sphere emanate two outcomes. Firstly, it duplicates the ways in which women speak of their grievances. Public debates, cahiers de doléances, letters, creation of feminist newspapers. Slowly but surely, women are gaining agency and expanding their political territory. Secondly, it also normalizes women using their voices in the public space, as a way to counter the ways in which they have been labeled as hystericals and troublemakers when voicing an opinion. The more women make their voices heard, the more they gain in assurance and respect, at least amongst their community. All in all, the female voice gradually becomes more politicized, and the works of feminists like Fanny Raoul show women of all classes that contrary to what they have been taught and conditioned to believe, women do belong in the political sphere. Arriving in Paris from her native Bretagne in 1800, Raoul quickly gets to work. In 1801, she writes A Woman's Opinion on Women. This pamphlet, which we'll delve into later in this episode, is a formal demand for gender equality and the first of many texts that Raoul will go on to write in which she advocates for women's rights in the French political sphere. 12 short years later, in 1813, she writes Flamini, or A Sensitive Woman's Mistakes, an epistolary novel. Through the story of a nanny working for a bourgeois family and who wishes to preserve her independence, Raoul denounces the weight of stereotypes and public opinion on women in a codified society. Later that same year, she writes philosophical and literary fragments, in which she notably accuses Académie Française member and theater director Alexandre Duval of plagiat. According to her, his play The Domestic Tyrant is inspired by her own play, The Tyrannomania. In said play, she refers to several types of fates that may be awaited by women, and notably discusses the danger of repeated pregnancies, which often cost women their lives. The controversy that ensues as a result of her accusing Duval earns her the nickname The Bretonne Amazon. The same year, still, she writes another three pamphlets in which she analyzes key political events. In one of them, A French Woman's Ideas on the Written or To-Be-Written Constitution, she expresses her fear that a return to an absolute monarchy may enable a specific class to claim their right to oppress all the others. Let us now go back to Raoul's first and perhaps most important work. In 1801, she writes A Woman's Opinion on Women, a pamphlet in which she demands that the rights enjoyed by women's male counterparts be extended to them. She begins said pamphlet with a dedication to women, whom she says are her sole motivations to write. It is not as an author that she publishes this work, she says, but as a sensible and reasonable woman, wishing to hold society accountable for the ways in which it allows unequal gender relations to endure. She begins by considering the nature versus culture dualism that governs much of the conversation regarding gender relations of her time. Arguing against the established consensus that nature and biology are responsible for women's inferiority, she argues that nature, in fact, predicts an identical destination for both sexes, reproduction. Because both are needed in order for it to happen, this dual necessity suggests a natural equality. The moment that one of the two sexes needs the other, it is placed in a position of equality towards the other. Additionally, and although French women will have to wait centuries for neurobiologist Catherine Vidal to categorically invalidate the beliefs according to which women's brains are biologically inferior to men's, in 1801, Raoul is already insistent that women's inferiorization is due to social determinisms and not to biological differences. In this regard, she accuses stereotypes, bad faith, and lies spread about women of being responsible for promoting the normalization of their minimization. Antic biases, she says, which a long usage have converted into laws, have established in the fate of both sexes a difference such as that one of the two seems to be born to oppress the other. According to her, the source of women's inferiorization is thus found in the ways in which sexes, or rather genders, are constructed. At a time where much of women's supposed inferiorities are blamed on biological factors, Raoul is essentially already identifying socialization as a conditioning tool that individuals in positions of power, men, use to organize and regulate gender relations. Later on, Raoul also challenges the allegation that women's servitude is linked to their inferior physical capabilities. In doing so, she highlights their strength within the reproduction process and says, which man pays with his health, with his life even, the advantage of being able to reproduce? And how many women are victims of this reproduction? How many of them give life at the expense of their own? Here, Raoul essentially challenges the ways in which men have, over time, appropriated the concept of physical strength. Strength is not simply found in wars or in combat, she argues, and not limited to men, but rather in any act that demands of an individual to show a display of fortitude. She also mentions the Amazons, the women of Sparta, but also paysannes, female peasants, and how these strong, fearless women are proof that women are not inherently physically inferior to men, but rather that physical training is the marker for bodily strength. Similarly, in attempting to prove the absurdity of judging one's morality by their physique, she brings in the examples of Aesop, Pascal, and Rousseau, all widely respected men despite their small height. Indeed, she argues, if it was the case that poor physical abilities justified being dominated by stronger others, then no doubt that these men, due to their unimpressive physique, would have lost their rights as men and citizens if only they had had to partake in a fight. Similarly, in ancient Rome, gladiators would surely have enslaved the preceptors of nations, who were physically weaker than them, although smarter. Contrary to the idea that these female weaknesses are biological, innate, and thus unfixable, Raoul argues that these deficiencies can in fact be rectified. Education, she argues, is necessary for the latter to happen. The same way that the Amazons and female peasants grew strong thanks to physical training, women can learn through intellectual training. Education, she argues, also plays a key role in giving women agency in the political sphere. Indeed, if it is in a government's interest to get the best out of the maximum of its citizens, then it should win in enabling women to be educated and thus be useful there too. Additionally, Raoul argues that women are more than just mere state contributors. They are indeed its condition, since they raise, child after child, the state's future citizens, actors, and defenders. Thus, the word citoyenne or female citizen cannot make sense unless women's role in the safekeeping and maintenance of the state is acknowledged. Similarly, in Vindication of the Rights of Women, written in 1792, 9 short years before Raoul's piece, writer Mary Wollstonecraft argues that by preventing a woman from being educated, her unpreparedness to assist men might stop the progress of knowledge and virtue. Though formulating their thoughts in different ways, Raoul's thinking merged with Wollstonecraft's in arguing that educating women is necessary in order to further progress. Raoul poses two questions. Either two individuals are the same species, and thus they must have the same advantages, or they differ so much that they do not have a single quality in common. However, this disparity does not exist in the intellectuals of two sexes. All throughout her pamphlet, Raoul also seems to hint at an inherent interconnectedness amongst different axes of inequality. In particular, she draws a parallel between the enslavement of women and that of black individuals. She says, thus, women became men's slaves, and thus, the people of another continent became the slaves of others, everywhere at least, where wisdom and impartiality of laws do not come to the rescue of the oppressed. Like Wollstonecraft, who argues that all forms of tyranny are interconnected, Raoul seems to believe that these forms of tyranny all have the same consequences on the oppressed. As such, putting an end to men's oppression of women might be justified for reasons of social utility. Raoul thus demands that women be given the same access to education that men enjoy if only men want to protect civil society. Central to Raoul's writing is also the ways in which unequal gender relations promote women's dependence on men. She laments the impossibility for women to assume their own finances, how society ingrains fairly early on in young women that their success lies in the prestige of their marriage, and that as such, cultivating their looks is of the utmost importance. She says, if instead of giving the prize to the most beautiful or the most elegant woman, we give it to the most educated, more spiritual, or more talented one, we would soon see a noble simplicity replace this expensive opulence and these clothing stores in which wealth is engulfed and often families honored with it, transform into libraries and workshops. Raoul is not alone in lamenting the ways in which young women are conditioned to view success. Similarly, Wollstonecraft describes a loop of oppression in which systematic relationships between the broader social context and inequalities lead to expectations of women developing and nurturing a singular capacity for sentimentality as their principal purpose in life. Taught to strive for a marriage to a rich husband, who would likely give them more freedom, women are thus expected to cultivate their appearance, but also an ability to both generate love and be the objects of love. In this context, women's education is thus oriented towards developing these qualities in order to prepare for their future. Similarly, Raoul argues that the more women are treated as slaves, the more they come to believe it, and, as a result, to quiet within themselves any aspiration to elevation. Independence, she argues, can only be gained through commanding respect. And likewise, commanding respect can only be gained through an education that women have yet to receive. In order to truly comprehend why Raoul's work is so singular, there are two elements in her speech that I want to highlight and which I think are particularly important. The first is the fact that Raoul's A Woman's Opinion on Women does not respond to any particular hostile attack on women, but rather that it strives to exist on its own within a general climate of misogyny. Traditionally, women writing in this time and age would typically be expressing a position vis-à-vis a masculine injunction. Indeed, we have Olympe de Gouges' Declaration of the Rights of Women and the Female Citizen, written in 1791 in response to the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Men and Citizen. We also have Constance de Salm responding to Écouchère Lebrun on a matter of gender equality in 1797. In this context, Raoul's work essentially appears to be a universal plea, targeting not one particular attack, but rather a multitude of attacks, a common perjuring battle that affects all or most women. And this, in more ways than one, is I think a new way of using speech as resistance. In a society that typically only allows women to speak when spoken to, and to answer only within the borders of the acceptable and the expected, Raoul shows that her voice knows no withholding, and that she does not need permission, nor will she ask for it, to raise her voice. The second feature of Raoul's speech that I want to highlight is the use of the word opinion. Raoul is essentially writing in between two periods. In the old regime, women were dependent on the opinion, with a capital O, forced and conditioned to show it an obedient and undisputable respect. In this sense, society thus overruled the individual, and for women, this meant conforming, complying, but mostly staying silent. Though unable to disagree with the opinion, women were nonetheless able to influence it, thanks to the literary salons that some women, not all, were free to attend and host. Yet, those contributions were merely allowed and far from being acknowledged as such. In the Republic, however, there was now a possibility that women may be encouraged not only to influence the opinion, but also to have one. Having an individual opinion, with a small o this time, essentially meant defying that capital O opinion. It implied a mutation, with the center of gravity drifting away from the group, from the consensus, to the singular, to the individual who thinks, who disagrees, and dares to say it. In this sense, Raoul's speech is just as much an individual protest as it is a collective one. Collective because it addresses all women and speaks to a multitude of their grievances. Individual because it also advocates for the right to have this opinion, one that does not need to exist with or resemble other opinions, but rather an opinion that can subsist on its own, and that constitutes a fundamentally needed democratic affirmation. Raoul ends her pamphlet with these words, "But it is not far, perhaps, this joyful time, this time when these unfair bases will crumble, and where we might even be surprised that they could once support human societies." She dies 32 years later after these lines were published, in 1833, at the age of 62, without ever having married or born children. Fanny Raoul spent her life fighting for women's rights, so that they may be able to be involved in politics, to receive an education, to free themselves of diminishing and deprecating biases, so that they may learn to recognize the barriers that are put on their path, that they may despise them, and that they may desire to defy them, so that they may influence the opinion, have an opinion, and be the opinion.